I want to pick up where we left off, which is we had the choice to make between three worldviews for how we're going to explain biodiversity. How did we get from the nothing to the diversity of life that we have now? And the only one of the worldviews that doesn't seek to answer the how did we get from nothing question, or at least can't answer it, is the first, the naturalistic worldview. It simply cannot explain where the first something that was came from. Then we talked about a second worldview that is theistic evolution, that says God created, God always was, God created from nothing, and one of the things that God created was a naturalistic process that we call evolution. That is how we got from the first simple that God created to the complex that we have today. And we talked about that worldview. Then we talked about a third option, which we labeled intelligent design, given our quibbles with the term. We labeled it intelligent design, and we said the idea here is God was more than just the explanation for the first stuff. That God actually carefully and intentionally created everything that is. And we talked about how that doesn't rule out natural selection, the idea that populations can evolve traits over time, and by evolve, we mean the trait is there, and because the trait is preferable, that trait continues. The monkeys with tails was our example. The monkeys whose tails are strong enough to hang from trees outlive the monkeys whose tails are not. And so over time, more and more, if not all monkeys, have strong enough tails to do that. So the intelligent design worldview doesn't exclude natural selection, but it does exclude the idea that chance is enough to get you from simple to complex, that we actually need design. And I said that's one of the first worldview choices you have to make as you think about Genesis 1 and 2, is which of these buckets do you fit in? Now, if you fit in bucket number 1, you're probably not here, right? People who say there is no God and that God is not a reasonable explanation for how the first stuff came to be, those people probably don't come to a Sunday school class, or at least my Sunday school class. The second category, theistic evolution, I pointed out some intellectual challenges that I have with it, but we did acknowledge that there are Jesus-loving, Bible-believing folks who fall in that camp, who look at the scientific evidence in this world and don't believe that you could reconcile that evidence with a literal six-day reading of Genesis 1, and so they say there has to be something in between, and they come up with this in between. And then the third camp, the intelligent design camp, has people from all walks of life. It has ardent atheists who say, there is no God. I can't tell you where the first stuff came from, but I can tell you that the data does not support purely naturalistic evolution. There's too much chance, there's too much diversity, there's not enough time, and it denies what they call our design instinct. And we talked about the soup example, that if you walked in your kitchen and you looked in a bowl of alphabet soup and you see the word cat, you think, well, that's cool. You walk in, you see the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence, and you say, somebody did that on purpose. That's what's called the design instinct. You can tell when something is too complex to be random. And the world fits into that category. The biodiversity that we have fits into that category. The way DNA works fits into that category. The way amino acids work and proteins work fit into that category. And so the intelligent design folks, some of them are conservative theologically, Christians. Some of them are atheists, and lots of them fit somewhere in between. My recommendation to you is to fall into the third camp, the intelligent design camp. That's the choice that I make. I agree that the empirical evidence in all fields of science points to a designer. Whether your field is astrophysics or biochemistry, all the evidence that we have points to a designer. All of it fits our soup analogy. All of it is simply too complex to have come about by chance. And some of that is as much art as science. But it's a very strongly grounded art, right? We look at it and we say, look, I couldn't draw the mathematical formula for why the Declaration of Independence can't show up in my soup, but I know it can't show up in my soup. Right? That's part of what we have at work here, that design instinct. And design instinct means more than just, or at least now, it means more than just this looks like it happened on purpose. That's one level of certainty, is you look at it and you say, probably on purpose. Intelligent design is more than that, because of the research that they're doing in biochemistry, especially because of what we're finding out about proteins, as I mentioned last week, we now say it cannot happen by chance. And you say, well, wait a minute, cannot seems a little too strong, because it's not zero out of 47 quadrillion chances. It's one out of 47 quadrillion chances. But in every other field of science, that's enough to say it cannot happen. We have not exhausted all of the possible tests for gravity that can be exhausted. But we've exhausted enough of them that we say gravity cannot be violated in this atmosphere, right? But we haven't tested 400 quadrillion different chances and choices with gravity. And yet we've tested enough. We say that doesn't happen. That's how science works. And what we're saying in intelligent design is, when you really get down into the study of biodiversity, when you study irreducible complexity, when you consider the notion of random genetic mutations being responsible for the complexity of life that we have, it cannot happen. Scientists that come out and say this get ostracized and have to move from institution to institution, because this is not a popular thing to say. There's a book on the back book table called Undeniable, which is by a scientist, he is a biochemist, who can tell you all about that. His experience of running simple tests and being asked to leave prestigious academic institutions for making claims that... and his partner in crime, so to speak, is an ardent atheist. That guy's not trying to sneak six-day creation in the back door. He's just trying to make sense of the data, and that's not real popular right now. So I would make the intelligent design choice. And just to reiterate what I said last week, if I were not a Christian, personally, I still would reject naturalistic Darwinian evolution. It doesn't fit the data. And if I were not a Christian, I would say, like all good scientists, that's only because we haven't come up with the right theory yet. There are lots of things in life we can't fully explain yet. There are lots of scientific concepts in the universe where we don't have the theory that fits yet. And if I were not a Christian, I would say, well, this is one of those. We keep studying. We keep positing theories. We keep testing things out. We look at the data. But there will be a naturalistic explanation for this, because the one we have doesn't fit. But I'm a Christian, so I can look at the Bible and say, well, the Bible gives me an explanation that does fit, that does fit the data. I don't need to come up with something else. What's strange to me, this is Paul the individual speaking. All right, remember I asked last week how each worldview would view Genesis 1? And for the naturalism guys, it's a silly myth. All cultures have one. They make up myths to explain a universe they don't understand. And for the theistic evolution guys, it is poetry. It is also an ancient people making sense of a world that they don't understand, but they're doing it in a way that's not an attempt to write a science textbook. They're doing it in a way that's an attempt to communicate an underlying message of importance to God's people. That's the theistic evolution view. How do we view Genesis 1, even if we believe in more than just Darwinian evolution? How do we read Genesis 1 if we take the intelligent design worldview? And the answer is lots of different ways. There are lots of different ways of approaching the text, even in this part of the spectrum. What are some of the ways that we can view Genesis 1? Well, the way that I'm going to argue Genesis 1 is actually intended to be read is as straightforward historical narrative. Six literal 24-hour days where God took discrete actions on each day in a purposeful way. He made something the way that he wanted it for a purpose in the day that Genesis 1 says that he made it. That doesn't mean he made every species of everything that exists that way. I believe in natural selection. But I don't think that God made single-cell protozoa and was excited when they eventually became a fish, or that God made single-cell protozoa and made a process by which they would become a fish. I believe God made fish. That's what Genesis 1 says, and that's how it's intended to be read. It's going to be my argument. But not everybody who believes that the Bible is the truthful word of God believes that. So what are some alternative points of view on how to read Genesis 1? Well, a really common one is called the day-age view. So nobody doubts, because we all can read, that Genesis 1 breaks down the creation into 6 days. What we're arguing over are two things. One is, what's the meaning of the word day? Is day meant to be taken literally, or is this just a literary device that's going to help us mentally process and organize and understand what God did? And then the second thing is biodiversity the result of intentional decisions by God? God made fish. Or is biodiversity the result of naturalistic process that God also made? We're all agreeing that God did this. Did God do it directly, or did God do it through a naturalistic process? Is the creation of everything that was created directly miraculous? And God spoke, and there was a bird. Or was it indirectly miraculous? God made the materials that birds would be made out of, and God made the process by which birds would come to exist, and then enough time passed, and there was a bird. That's what we're disagreeing over when we look at, when Christians who believe the Bible look at Genesis 1. So the day-age view says days in Genesis 1 each represent day equals long periods of time. The days don't represent 24-hour days as we know them. The days represent very long periods of time. The creation days are 6 sequential. That's the order by which the process unwound, or the order by which God acted, but they're not literal 24-hour days. They represent long periods of time. There are lots of people that you've heard of who hold this view. Hodge, Warfield, Machen, Schaefer. Lots of names that you'll recognize from 19th and 20th century theology and books that you've read and people that I quote in sermons. Lots of people hold this view. Part of the reason for this view is their belief that, so I'll say why. Why this? The universe is very old. If you do the math, taking Genesis 1 in a literal 6 24-hour day sense, and then you do the math on the genealogies that come after that, you end up with a universe that is roughly 6,000 years old. So if you take the view that I take about how Genesis is intended to be read, you're left to conclude that the universe, day one, is 6,000 years old. Well, what many scientists are compelled to believe, and what many scientists have presented as the data, is that the universe is much, much older than this. And then Christians are left with a dilemma. Because if that's true, that if we could actually know, factually, that the universe is 4 billion years old, 50 million years old, whatever it is, if we knew it was this big, huge number that made Genesis's number impossible, then we have to come up with, okay, what can't mean literal 24-hour days? Because we know factually that's not true. So we've got to come up with another theory. So one of the theories that they come up with is day-age. It respects the fact that creation is presented in this order. It respects the fact that creation is presented as the special, intentional, miraculous work of God. It just says the world cannot be 6,000 years old, so this cannot be a 24-hour day. It has to be a much longer period of time. But what they're trying to do here is to solve a legitimate problem. And they're solving a legitimate problem by a legitimate means, which is, I think they're wrong that the data says the world is older than this. But if they were right, this is a legitimate approach. Right? Part of how we determine the genre of something is if what it's saying is impossible. It could be just wrong, or it could be saying it in a non-literal way. And we have to look to other clues in the text. That doesn't answer the, is this historical narrative or is this poetry? But it is one clue that you look at. If it's saying something impossible, am I reading satire or real news? You remember when that used to be easy? It used to be easy to read a news article and know what was satire and what was real, because you'd read it and you'd say, oh, that's impossible, this is satire, haha, that's funny. And now you read front page articles on the Wall Street Journal and you say, is this satire? Is this right? That's one of the clues that you use. So far, you guys are nibbling around the edges of some challenges we have with this, and I agree with that, but so far they're doing a legitimate thing by a legitimate means. Their problem is their presuppositions. That's always the problem here. The problem with every mistaken worldview is presuppositions. And the real problem with the day-age worldview is one presupposition called uniformitarianism. This is the commitment that everything we can observe in the universe today happens as it has always happened at the speed which it has always happened. That's a pretty strong commitment, is to say all of these constants that we talk about in science and all of these constants that we learn in math, we learn these numbers where we say, this is always that. The area of a circle is always relative to the number pi, which is a constant, 3.14159, blah, 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 right? So pi is a constant. We say that's never going to change. It's always been that way. Well, we say that about the speed of light, that the speed of light is not changing. Lots of constants in science. One of them relative to this discussion is the speed at which carbon breaks down. All radiometric carbon dating is based upon the idea that carbon has always and does always, in each stage of its life cycle, break down at exactly the same rate. That's fine. That could be true. But that's an assumption. That's not a fact. That's an assumption. And so you're building your universe dating methodology around assumptions, which is fine. But don't build your worldview around non-proven assumptions and tell me that my worldview is wrong because it's built around non-proven assumptions that God is the ultimate author of the Bible. We're on equal footing here. We are both making assumptions about how to interpret the data. Yours are naturalistic assumptions. That's fine. You cannot look at my supernatural assumptions and say that I'm somehow insane and you're brilliant. Right? That's not a step that you should take. The other assumption within this, so same way, same speed is one assumption that we just talked about. The other assumption in this is that we started from zero. If the universe started at zero, and God said, boom, and made the sun, would the light be on the earth immediately? Well, no, the light would have to travel to the earth. And if we can see stars that we know, because we can measure it now, are millions and millions of miles away, and we say it would take 4 million years for the light to get from that star to our planet. So if we could see that light, then we know Well, the world is at least 4 million years old because that light had time to get here. It could be 4 million in 1 second. It could be 40 million, but we know it's at least 4 million years old because the light that started 4 million years away already made it here. Y'all see how this works? But there's a big assumption in there that it started from zero. That when God created the stars, he didn't create the stars already visible from the earth, that he just created the stars, and then the light needed its 4 million years to get here. And you say, well, that's reasonable, because if I go into space right now and I turn on a flashlight, I can't make the flashlight automatically appear on the earth. I need 4 million years for the light to get here to the earth. But you see how that's an assumption? Was Adam created as an infant? Was Adam ever an embryo? Was Adam ever third trimester fetus? Was Adam ever in diapers? God created Adam not just with the appearance of age, but with actual age, right? He created Eve with actual age. Was every tree in the garden a seed? No. He didn't create trees with the appearance of age. He created trees with actual age, fruit-producing trees. So you can make the assumption, if you want to, that the universe started from zero and that everything God made, including the light-producing bodies, started from zero. Or you could make the assumption that when God created Adam as a, 27-year-old dude, he also created a 5-million-year-old star. He also created a 2-billion-year-old universe, if that's what you need. God has the ability to start from something other than zero, and we know for a fact that in at least one instance, what he created on earth, he actually did. The fish were full-blown fish. They weren't caviar. All the animals, all the plants, the people that he made, all of it was created with actual age. I don't have to accept the assumption that the universe, everything else, started from zero. We take things that we observe. We observe beach erosion. We observe erosion on all kinds of hills. And we say, what we observe is the objective and perfect model for how everything has always been. And that's a totally reasonable, unproven assumption. I'm allowed to build my worldview around that assumption. I have to acknowledge it's an assumption. And when I run into a problem with my assumption, I have to look at other alternatives, other assumptions. This is what we all have to do. This is part of building a logical, rational worldview. So the day-age folks said, look, the age of the universe, whether it's in astrophysics or in geology, suggests a very, very, very old universe and a very old planet. And because it's an old planet, these cannot be 24-hour days. We need more time. And so the way that we get more time is to make these, instead of literal days, to make these indeterminate periods of time. But they're not saying it's 6 equal days. They're just saying you're missing the point if you're making these 24-hour days. The other thing they're saying, and again, they is a big bucket here, so you got to separate out some theologians, but the ones that I would lend the most credibility to, they're even preserving special creation because they're saying that God made light and then allowed enough time for the light to get from the place he made it on earth before he separated the land from the waters. And so however much time is needed for that, that's what gets here. Well, then when you get to creatures, they preserve special creation of most creatures because they say he made the birds and he allowed enough time to take place for evolution to do its thing so that we got significant biodiversity in birds. I'm going to give you all my problems with that later. But they are legitimately trying to preserve God as more than just the deistic first mover, that God was a special and purposeful creator. There are different varieties of day-age. There are progressive creationists. There are those that saw God as working through a back-and-forth process between the supernatural and the natural. God would supernaturally intervene to create something, either simple or some intermediate state of simplicity and complexity, and then it would get to play out. It would get to grow. It would get to come diverse. Do you know the Ross Archer view? Millions of generations predate human life. There was tons and tons of plant and animal generations before human life ever got on the planet. And because the universe changed, the temperature changed, the atmospheric composition changed, you'd have complete extinction, and then God would have to recreate, and then complete extinction, and God would recreate. And that's based on the fossil record, which is really problematic for regular evolutionary views. The fossil record doesn't make any sense. You've got these species that show up out of nowhere. Where did this come from? You know, when you go to the Natural History Museum, any Natural History Museum, and you read the little plaques, you will always find plaques that say, there's a gap between the common ancestor and this form that we found. Well, they've just made up the fact that it's the common ancestor, and the reason that they think there's a gap is because you can't get from here to here, right? So, oh, there's a gap. We're still looking for that species. You see that all the time in Natural History Museums. All right, so... big problem with the day-age view that we have to throw at them is, well, yeah, but yom, which is the Hebrew word for day. God says day all over Genesis 1, the first day, the second day. And they say, wait a minute, that is no problem at all. The word yom is used all over the Bible, and it's used in lots of places where it refers to something other than a literal 24-hour day. That word doesn't mean literal 24-hour day everywhere it appears. Oh, yeah, I meant to hand out Bible verses for today. Somebody look up Isaiah 11:10. Matt's got it. John, would you go to Psalm 94? Sorry, Psalm 90, verse 4. And Matt, you've got Isaiah 11:10 and 11, please.
In that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious.
You think that's a pretty important verse in the Bible? That's a pretty important verse in the Bible. Is it talking about a literal 24-hour day? No. John 90, verse 4.
For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch.
I got another even easier one. Craig, your Bible's open. Genesis 2:4. Let's just go to the next creation story.
These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens.
In the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Is he talking about a literal 24-hour day there? No. Yom appears all over the Bible where it doesn't mean literal 24-hour day. We got a verse in Psalm that makes it clear that God's days are not our days. His view of time is not ours. And therefore, the day-age folks, and this is also going to be true when we get to the literary framework folks, Yom problem is not a problem. That's the answer to that. I would say I disagree. And I disagree for linguistic reasons, not theological reasons. We have in every language what we call common constructs. Words have multiple meanings, but when words are attached to other words, we know what that means, right? We talked about this last week with the word sunrise or sunset. We talked about this with the word everyone. Everyone was at the party, everyone. So there are common constructs, ways we use words that are an indicator for what we mean. Do I mean the literal meaning of this word? Do I mean the more figurative meaning of this word? Or is the whole phrase an idiomatic expression? If you guys studied foreign languages, you know idiomatic expressions are really difficult to translate, right? Because we've got these phrases, don't put the cart before the horse, that when you translate it into Spanish, people just stare at you. What in the world did you just say? Right? That happens in every language. So common constructs are not idiomatic expressions, but they are common phrases or common pairings of words or common pairings of tenses. Once upon a time. What do you know about what I'm going to say next? It's a fairy tale. Once upon a time. Right? That's a common construct. It tells you whatever words come next, they're in the fairy tale genre. So when we say Yom appears in the Bible in lots of different ways, that's true. It appears in the Bible in lots of ways that mean 24-hour day and ways that don't. So the next step of that discussion is not to simply say, therefore it can mean whatever you want it to mean wherever it appears. It's to say, in the places where it does mean literal 24-hour days, is there anything we could look at in those passages that's different from the other passages and say, okay, Genesis 1 is just Yom. Just Yom. When you have Beit Pasyom with an infinitive, because what that creates is an expression that we would translate it literally in the day, we would translate it idiomatically as when. So Genesis 2, if we were paraphrasing it, we would say, when God created the heavens and the earth. The literal translation is, in the day when God created the heavens and the earth. But what Genesis 2 does not say is day. It says in the day. It says when.